människor.
Modiga människor.
Modiga människor.
Modiga människor.
Modiga människor. So, here I am with Robert Malone at the Swedish Doctor Conference in Stockholm. And for me, it's really a historical weekend. I mean, with all the doctors being here and professors and I mean, and all the audience. I mean, there's so much people here. And I'm standing here with you. And yesterday, you talked about the fifth generation of warfare. And can you tell us a little about that?
So, here in the 21st century, we face a very different information environment and environment, you could call it a battlefield for competition between nations, states, economies, organizations. It's very different from the 20th century. This concept of fifth generation warfare, which is not a term I invented, this is a common language. This is really a little bit of a misnomer, a wrong word, fifth generation warfare, because it implies that there was a discrete difference between first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. But that's not true. They're really more like gradients. And you can think of the gradient as moving from direct combat between individuals or small groups of individuals, you know, the proverbial competition between tribes would maybe be zero generation warfare, or fights between individuals are kind of like that. And at the other end, and often those competitions historically have been about territory and other resources. And then at the other extreme of this gradient of competition or conflict, we have the modern embodiment in which the battlefield is the minds of people, their thoughts, their emotions, their belief systems. So this is a form of propaganda taken to the extreme. Propaganda has always been part of warfare and conflict. And so, in short, the gradients of warfare span from this generation zero, where it might be us fighting over something, resources or territory, to first generation, where we had battle lines, horses, spears, swords, things like that, to second generation, where we have gunpowder and what we call kinetic weapons, bullets, things like that. So, you know, the old, the Battle of Agincourt with the longbow, that's first generation warfare, the knights in armor, fighting in armies that are structured, that have central commands reporting up to the king. That's first generation. Second generation, you can think of as World War I, okay, where you had battle lines, you have these industrialized kinetic weapons, things have gotten larger scale. Third generation warfare, you can think of as World War II. The big difference that gave the Germans such an advantage in their blitzkrieg of Europe and through the war was allowing autonomy at the commander level, so that instead of everything being centralized and controlled from above, there was guidance, strategic planning, overall objectives, and then down at the level of the battalion or brigade, tank commander units, etc., were given a lot of freedom to innovate in the battlefield. So that's third generation warfare. Fourth generation warfare is what we've experienced. One modern embodiment of that that's often cited is Al-Qaeda. So this asymmetric warfare in a world in which you have one or more dominant powers, military dominant powers that are so dominant that they really cannot be confronted militarily using kinetic weapons, such as the United States, of course, we call as superpowers, right? And so in a battlefield environment dominated by a superpower, what can be done in an asymmetric warfare fashion? That's fourth generation warfare. And I argue, and I think many others do, the United States has not won a single fourth generation war. The Vietnam War was a fourth generation war. Iraq was a fourth generation war in many cases. It started off as third generation with the tanks, and then it moved to more of an insurgency. Syria is another one. One of these recent Israeli conflicts. A case can be made that Arab Spring was the first unintentional fifth generation warfare. Okay, so in fifth generation warfare, the battleground is no longer about who controls territory. And it often doesn't involve kinetic weapons, although it can. It involves the extension of propaganda to an endpoint where the battlefield is all about convincing minds. And so there is a whole suite of technology that's enabled in large part by the internet, by modern communication technologies. And that has all been weaponized. And there are methods, strategies, tactics that have been actively developed by the U.S. military, by the Five Eyes Alliance. This is U.K., U.S., Australia, New Zealand, Canada is the Five Eyes Alliance, that had been developed as technology for trying to overcome fourth generation, this guerrilla or asymmetric warfare strategy. And unfortunately, these technologies that have been developed for offshore combat against hostile foes have, to a significant extent, been deployed against civilian populations by their own governments in the context of the last 3 years of the corona crisis.
So can you, I mean, for example, say that the fact that there is no press here from the MSM media this weekend, is that a part of this?
I would say it's more like a derivative.
Okay.
So what you're referring to, I call corporate media. You call mainstream media. I think the term mainstream media is outdated, personally. Remember that corporate media and their trade organization, the Trusted News Initiative, which ties them all together, is largely owned by a very, very small number of companies globally.
Yeah.
And those companies are owned by basically large transnational hedge funds that also own Pfizer and the banks and everything else. Okay, so really now what you're calling mainstream media and I'm calling corporate media is really just another division of a company or a group, small group of companies, a consortium of Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock, et cetera, that also own Pfizer, that also control the banks, that also control virtually every corporate aspect of our lives. The New York Times put out an article a few months ago in which it suggested that BlackRock, within the next 3 years, would control over 98% of corporations in the United States. So what you're calling corporate media is really a division of these very large transnational organizations. And so it's no surprise that they act to support the interests of their corporate owners. And what's happened is that as a consequence of that and of corporate media becoming increasingly dependent on the state also for funding, is that many of these corporate media outlets, as embodied in the Trusted News Initiative and their various affiliates worldwide, Agence France-Presse, et cetera, the BBC, of course, manages the Trusted News Initiative globally. All of these are tied together with big tech, and they act to support the interests of their corporate masters and the nation states that host them, the official governments. And so that business model is increasingly failing. You can see it in their own internal evaluations, like from the Poynter Institute that comes out annually. And they perceive alternative media, particularly the podcast, as their major threat. They identify their major threat as a business is exemplified by Joe Rogan. I mean, Joe Rogan, with his audience of over 11 million followers that are in their mid-20s, the key demographic, is a major threat. And it really demonstrates the risk that corporate media is confronting now as their business model is failing. So I object to this term mainstream media when talking about these people. They're more like an old business model that's failing.
Yeah, can you say like it's mainstream media is dead?
It's not dead yet. It's dying.
But it's dying.
It is absolutely dying.
It's going against.
And they know it's dying. Yeah. And they're scared about it, but they cannot break out of this dependency they have. And so they're, you know, this is why organizations like CNN get smaller and smaller over time. Here's a fun fact. This is fascinating. I'm not bragging. But our Substack essays that we put out on a daily basis, only my wife and I, and we have some other writers that occasionally contribute, we reach about the same daily audience that CNN Primetime does. Okay? That's, that, you know, I have maybe 1.5 million followers, and our Substack reaches about 500,000 to 1 million a day. Joe Rogan reaches over 11 million day after day after day. That just completely destroys the circulation of most of these outlets. And so we're in a period of transition. And so I'm not really worried about the fact they're not here. What I'm worried about is, can we get truth responsibly to our audiences, our viewers? Can we police ourselves? Can we act responsibly to share true information in this new fragmented information landscape where your followers and my followers can choose who they want to follow? And I think this is really good. They're getting different points of view on a daily basis by looking for these different sources, and then they can make their own decisions. And I think this is how we become stronger. This is essential to the concept of democracy, of citizen decision making in politics and everything else, that people have a diverse media landscape, information landscape, not instead of just being fed like back in the former Soviet Union with Pravda, only being fed what the state wants them to hear. Because much of what we think of as leaders in corporate media, for instance, in the United States, it's clear now that CNN, Washington Post, and New York Times, and NPR, all basically reflect the point of view of the current administration. They've become mouthpieces for the state. And that's not good for democracy.
No. Robert, what do you think at the moment? What's the most important thing to raise at the moment? I mean, the most important question.
About what, COVID or about the bigger picture?
The bigger picture.
Yeah, I think COVID is really a three-year demonstration that we're in the middle of that has revealed much of what has been done in the world in terms of these public-private partnerships and transnational organizations, globalist organizations. We can now see these things. We can see their strategies, the plans that they've implemented, such as Agenda 2030 with the United Nations, the strategies such as the international health regulations that are trying to be they're trying to advance with the World Health Organization, all of which really are built around the idea that the nation state is obsolete and that in order to solve the world's problems, we have to have more centralized control. We have to have more authoritarian control. We have to have more information on every single individual so that we can feed it into our algorithms, our computational algorithms, our deep learning and artificial intelligence, and it will tell us how to optimize management of the world under a command economy so that we can have the greatest good for the greatest number. This is the belief system that is being advanced. And I suggest that the experience of the last 3 years clearly demonstrate that that concept is invalid. What we have seen is gross incompetence, repeated incompetence in management of public health, backed by propaganda, compromised by financial conflict of interest. It is just goes on and on and on. And if this is the type of management that the likes of BlackRock and the World Economic Forum and the people that wish to assimilate the Chinese model for managing the world, if this is an example of the type of management capabilities that they would bring to fore, I'm not convinced at all that these are the people that we should place our trust in to manage the world. I personally believe strongly that a decentralized world is one that will enable innovation, and a centralized world is one that will destroy the human spirit, and will also destroy human innovation, and will lock us into a future which has many of the darkest aspects of the past, in which we have control and decision making dominated by a small elite. Time has proven that control by a small elite through a command economy structure absolutely does not yield the greatest good for the greatest number. And so I think that's the big issue right now.
But
is how do
solution,
we
huh?
how do we as humanity how do we as humanity fulfill our potential? And is our potential as a species best optimized by allowing corporatist governance of the world? I don't see that. I don't see any evidence that that's the case. I see that as destroying what makes us human, and destroying the ability of the human species to fulfill its potential, not enabling it. And I think that's our biggest challenge going forward, is how, in the face of this decades, generations of planning that have now matured to the point that we see it embodied in the COVID crisis management of the last 3 years, or mismanagement, what is that the legacy? Is that the world that we want to give to our children? And if not, what can we do? And as I've traveled all over the world, last year I booked over 400,000 miles on commercial carriers, speaking all over the world, and not to mention all the Zoom calls. What I hear is a strong desire for a more decentralized, autonomous world in which there's the freedom for individuals to assemble in groups, build their own communities, celebrating their own cultures, but yet enable an interconnectedness, an ability to trade and engage in transactions without requiring that we all subsume our identities into some common globalist view of who we should be and how we should act. And how to do that is really difficult problem, because everything that anyone that I've encountered can envision for how to organize ourselves in intentional communities that are interconnected like this. People are always biased by what they've experienced in the past. We have this bias based on what we know. And so it's very hard to envision a world that's different from what we've experienced in the past. So often when people start talking and trying to think these things through, they come right back to the same problems that we've always had. I think this is our biggest challenge and our biggest opportunity is to envision a way for humanity to exist in a decentralized way, not a centralized globalist way, that values our individuality and yet enables our cooperation. And this is a hard problem, but I think it's a solvable one. But I think we're the only way to get to that solution is through trial and error. And not to sound too American, but I do think that the what happened in the formation of America, of the United States, was a special experiment in autonomy and decentralized control. The United States, unfortunately, has veered away from that to this centralized administrative state that seeks to dominate the world. I think we have gone awry in that. But the documents and the thinking and the process around the idea of a consortium of semi-autonomous, smaller, independent political organizations that we call states that are akin to the European states that have allied under the United Nations, I mean, under the European Union, that idea, I think, still has a lot of merit. I think that Europe is facing a major challenge right now as Brussels has used economic forces to basically control independent nation states throughout the EU, like Italy, for instance, that have very little autonomy left because they're so indebted. Somehow, Europe has also lost its way from the idea of a coalition of autonomous nation states. And I think that both Europe and the United States face a major challenge in thinking through what they've done and what can be done to go back to something akin to the original concept.
Now I have a last question for you. And it's, are you hopeful for the future?
You have to be hopeful. This is one of the problems that I'm addressing, trying to address right now in my talks. This is why I gave this talk, rather than talking about RNA. Over the last year and a half, my wife and I have invested a lot of time in building this book, The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Ahead, The Better Future Coming. And it's been a journey of discovery and exploration that we share with our readers to help them to make that journey also of understanding what this new world is about. And often when people finish reading that book or finish reading Bobby Kennedy's book about Anthony Fauci, they can feel helpless and hopeless. That the powers are so overwhelming and they feel so powerless. And I think that what I'm taking as my personal challenge right now is not only doing what I can to protect our children, which has been my mission now for over a year, but also empowering people, showing people that they don't have to be victims, that they can actively influence the world in many different ways. And that's one of the beauties and why I speak about fifth generation warfare is because these technologies for information war, competition for the mind and for ideas, this battlefield of ideas, these technologies that have been developed for military purposes and have been deployed against us, we can also use. And they can empower common people. Everybody can be empowered if they learn these strategies and technologies and start interacting in social media and in the grocery store when they go to get their cheese and bread with the people in line. You know, talk about what they know to be true. The risk is that people will choose to try to behave like corporate media and spread propaganda and lies. We have to, I believe firmly, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard, a higher ethic, but we can still use these new technologies and methods to spread information and help move us all forward to a better future.
Thank you, Robert.